So if you haven't figured out, we're going to talk about hunting today. Well, at least I was asked, when am I going to do a sermon on hunting? Because people wanted to know if that I had a similar amount of hunting gear, which I do not. I want you to go ahead and read the Fisherman's Serenity Prayer. If you've never read it before, it may be one you need to memorize if you are a fisherman, especially the last line. Because it brings things back into perspective. I need some help, and before you comment on that statement, I'll go ahead and beat you to the punch. I was going to ask Tim Rundle to help me out today, but they are not able to be with us. So I need someone who knows a little bit about fishing, so I've asked Shane if he would help me out. So Shane, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. I want you to come up here onto the stage since you're shorter than I am. And that way everybody can see you. And I just want you to help me out for just a little bit, okay? So, I mean, you know I love to go fishing, and sometimes we've gone fishing together. When I am going to go fishing for panfish, you know, bluegills, that type of thing, when I'm over at your pond, of the poles that you see up here, which one would maybe be the one that you would say, that would probably work the best?
Well, maybe out of these, this one or that. And like you say, the panfish are only 6 to 9 inches, so you don't need a big, long rod, powerful rod to bring them in. So I seen you using this in our house the other day. I would probably use that smaller one over there, but either one would be fine.
You're talking about this one here?
Yeah, possibly.
Okay. Now, I actually got this rod because you picked on me when I went trout fishing with you the very first time. And I had a very long rod, and so you're like, don't you have a trout fishing rod? And I said, no, I don't, because I'm not the smartest fisherman. Now, let's say I was going to do some bass fishing, okay? I'm going to go to Cadores, or I'm going to go down on the river somewhere, and I'm going to fish for smallmouth bass, for some largemouth bass. What pole would you suggest?
Well, bass are a little bit bigger, 12 to 18 inch range, and sometimes you need to cast a long ways along the bank. So the longer your pole is, then you can cast farther. So I would probably pick this one. Plus, it has more power in fighting a bigger fish.
Okay. So this pole actually came as a gift to me when I left Whitehall. One of our members gave this to me just soon before we left. One of our members passed away that I helped to take care of, and his family said he would want you to have this. So they went and got me a really nice kind of bass fishing pole, and I really appreciate it. And it's probably my go-to pole, to be really honest, maybe because of the memory. Sometimes Carrie and I go to Canada to go fishing for northern pike, for muskie. Which pole would be the best to go muskie fishing?
Muskies can be 30 to 50 inch range, so big, powerful fish. I would probably use that big rod there in the end to give you lots of leverage to bring in a bigger fish.
Okay. And this particular one, of course, got a much bigger reel on it and a much thicker line on it. Even it has a metal leader. Just a question. So if I want to go fishing for bluegill at your pond, and I brought this pole to go fishing for the bluegill at your pond, could I catch bluegill on this pole?
You could. It would be very hard to feel them bite because there's not much sensitivity in that rod. And when you set the hook, there's no forgiveness. You could probably just yank them right out of the water.
Or rip it out of their mouth, probably. Yeah. I wouldn't mind yanking them out of the water. That would save me. And obviously, what's this for?
Well, that's the most important piece of your fishing move, because you can do all this fishing and study them and figure out how to catch them. And the guys I fish with, if there's no pictures, it didn't happen. So if you want to save your catch and be able to dip that down in the water and bring them out and save what you went for, that's a vital part.
Okay. And so just to make sure I'm hearing all of this correctly, the rod and reel that I use, I would pick because of the type of fish I was going after. The lures that I might use on those rod and reels. So I'm probably not going to use my musky bait on a little ice fishing rod to go after bluegill. So
no.
I'm not going to do that. So all of that makes a difference. But I could catch even a small bluegill on a bait that might be used for a bass. A bluegill may, or a crappie or something may hit even a bait that is probably a little bigger than its intended purpose. Is that correct?
It happens. Yes.
It happens. Okay. And obviously you need all the right stuff. So you can go ahead and sit down. I just wanted you to give me that information. I want you to have that information in your head because I think it's important to do that. I want you to raise your hand if you believe this statement that I'm about to read to you. Disciples make disciples. If you believe that as a statement, I want you to raise your hand. Disciples make disciples. Well, I am seeing pretty much every hand go up. Let me ask you the converse of that, okay? And no, I'm not talking about tennis shoes. Let me ask you the opposite of that. If I am not actively sharing Jesus, am I a disciple? I'm not asking you to answer that. You all just raised your hands a few moments ago that said disciples make disciples. But if as a disciple I decide I'm just me, okay? I'm not anybody. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not anything. I'm going to go to church and I'm going to sing my songs and say prayers and worship, take communion, go home. That's kind of my Christian life. I'll give the church 1 hour on Sunday morning to be there. But that's just kind of where I am. If we all raise our hand and say disciples make disciples, is not actively trying to share Jesus, looking for opportunities, does that speak about my discipleship, my connectivity to Christ, my following Jesus, my surrendering to Jesus? I'm not going to make a law where God did not make a law. And I do believe that as you read through the New Testament, there are people that are called evangelists. And many times they describe somebody in my position within a local congregation. I believe that there are people that are gifted as evangelists. Not all of them stand up and preach. Some of them are just very gifted as evangelists. And I do believe that those are gifts given by the Holy Spirit. And therefore, someone who is gifted as an evangelist needs to do the gift that God has given to that person, he or she, and evangelize. That being the case, I would come back and say, well, not everybody is an evangelist in the technical sense of the word that is used, like a shepherd of the church or an evangelist or a deacon that may have titles, okay? Maybe you don't fit the title. I would come back to say that every single disciple of Jesus Christ has at their core a desire to want to see others go to heaven also. I think that's at their core. They just want to see that happen. The difficulty often comes in how we judge ourselves or look at ourselves to say whether or not I know my Bible well enough, whether or not, and so can I do a Bible study? Could I lead someone to Christ? Do I know the right scriptures? So we get into these self-defeating conversations. That's not even my question. As a disciple of Jesus Christ, do I truly desire to make disciples for Jesus Christ? Is that a part of who I am? Or is my Christian life more about being a receiver from Christ than the giver of Christ to others? The receiver And I'm telling you, I've been on all of these ends, so I'm not picking on anybody. The receiver, well, that's okay. That was my least favorite pole. Okay, just got to tell you, I got this pole at Community Aid. It's as limber as a wet dish rag. I love this pole when I'm fishing for really small fish. Anyway, I don't know where I was. Coming back to where I was. I've been at both ends of that. I've been in a position where I'm a receiver. A receiver is the person who, and I'm not picking on anybody, okay, because I don't know what's going on in your head. Receiver is the person that evaluates the worship service as it's going on, okay? Man, Alan spoke forever at the call to worship. How long is that song going to go? I wish you would have picked a different song. Those songs just really don't speak to me. You know, when it comes to the table, can't they just do it like the way they used to do it when we pass the plates and everybody should be able to do it? When I'm judging the entire worship service as it is going on, it's really about me. I mean, that's just where it is. It's not a giver. I'm not even glorifying God. I'm just seeking to say, what do I get from the hour that I'm here? And if the preaching doesn't lead me anywhere and the singing doesn't take me where I want it to go and the prayers don't lift me up, well, I'm going on to find another place. And I can understand some of that, but really that mindset is, it's about me. It's really not about God. It's not about truth. It's not about the church. It's not about family. It's not about community. It's just simply about me, what I get, what I don't get. Okay, are there enough things for my kids to do? Are there enough things for my grandparents to do? Whatever it is, okay, it's about me. But the other side of that is to say, how do I learn to be the spiritual giver? How do I bless others? In fact, we're really going to take a look at that next week. So what I want to do today is just talk a little bit about some fishing techniques. At the beginning of this sermon, before all of my stuff started falling down, at the beginning of this sermon, we walked through and I had Shane kind of pick out different rods and reels, and we didn't get into the lures and stuff. We understand that, okay? If I'm going to go fishing for smaller panfish, I'm just not going to take a pole that I go fishing for muskie with. It's not going to happen. It's just the wrong tool for the occasion. And if I'm going to go fishing for muskie, I'm probably definitely not going to take this limber pole that couldn't set the hook no matter how hard it tried. Okay? I'm just not going to go down that road. But somehow I have put into my head that if I'm going to talk about being a fisher of men, that there is like one way to do evangelism. And that was defined somewhere in 1950, and that's exactly the way it's going to be, and nobody gets to deviate from the plan. And as we come to take a look at God's Word, I think what we're going to see is when we go fishing, we have to begin to understand the soul of the person to whom we are talking. So the approach changes depending upon the person, depending upon where they are in life, depending upon what's happening in their life. If they're going through a very difficult time in their life, or if they're going through a great time in their life, if they've just celebrated the birth of a child or the birth of a grandchild, I'm going to approach that person differently. Can I always be talking about Jesus? Yes. But the method of which I do it and the way that I present that message changes depending upon who the person is. I'm going to spend some time in Acts chapter 17. You can turn there if you want. But I'm going to open with this passage, Acts 17. I'm going to begin down in verse 16. It says, now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, I want you to see this. His spirit was, and I don't know what your translation may have. This, the ESV says, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw the city was full of idols. This idea, his soul was provoked. There is an intenseness behind it, okay? It's not anger so much, his whole insides are just looking at this idolatry, and he's just struggling of, okay, what's the next thing? Because what I am seeing is so, so wrong. Okay? This city is doing nothing but worshiping every god but Jehovah. And they have it in their head that there are all of these different gods. And so the inside of him is provoked. The inside of him has been incensed. In a sense, not that he's angry with everybody, but he is, if you want to go that route, he's angry with the sin that he sees of idolatry. But this is a huge stirring within him. This is not just, and I've not had the pleasure, and I really would love, if God allows me, I'd love to sometime kind of walk through some of the areas of the Middle East and into Israel, but even into the Greece and Italy area and all around that area, and walk through some of these places. My mom and dad did, and they took pictures, and we talked when they came home. But you know, they didn't say, oh, when we saw this catacombs, or when we saw these things that are still, I mean, literally thousands of years old, where they were worshiping Zeus or some other god. They didn't talk about being incensed by it. They didn't talk about being provoked in their spirit. It was kind of a history thing that they walked through and that they saw. Paul is living this. This is where the people are right now. And what he sees in the people right now is idolatry. What he sees in the people right now is people who are turning to something other than God, and it doesn't sit within him. He can't handle that angst that it brings about within him. The next verse 17. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. He reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews. The first thing Paul almost always does when he goes to a town is he finds where the Jewish people are, and he goes and he tries to talk to them. He does so in part because he is a Jewish person. He goes there because he has been trained in the Jewish law. He knows the law of Moses very, very well, studied at the feet of Gamaliel, raised knowing all of that. He goes to, if you will, his people. Okay? And he reasons with them about Jesus. Now, these are people who are also living amongst all of this idolatry. But there doesn't seem to be this strong Jewish community that is trying to take Jehovah into Athens. And so Paul goes there and he reasons with them. He has this biblical discussion with them. The next verse, come down to the next one. Some of the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching the resurrection, preaching Jesus and the resurrection. He has a different set of fish. So he's been speaking to the Jews. Now he's going to begin this conversation to these Stoics and these Epicureans, these philosophers, and he changes his approach. So he has been reasoning with the Jews in the synagogue over the law, but sitting down with the law of Moses and trying to describe Jesus through Isaiah 53 to a Greek philosopher living in Athens just isn't the right way to go. It isn't. Do you think the Greek philosopher that was there really cared about the book of Isaiah and what it had to say about the Messiah? Probably not. So he changes his approach in how he does it. He gets invited to speak at this, to this larger audience at a place called the Areopagus on, and that is held at Mars Hill. And Mars Hill is truly nothing but this big stone, is what it is. And these type of chairs were set up, not quite an amphitheater style, but similar to that. And he gets invited there because that's where they kind of go for their debates around philosophy. So I'm going to pick up with verse 22 and read just a couple of verses. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." Paul changes everything. He changes the approach because he's got a whole different group of people here. You know what? We read how when he saw all of those idols, how he was just provoked inside of him, just kind of his blood is boiling of, I just can't understand how people are so far removed from God. But when he gets the opportunity to talk to those people, he doesn't say, "You idiots. How could you build a stone and put some inscription on it and think that's God? Are you dumber than a box of rocks? Well, it is a box of rocks. So maybe you are dumber than a box of rocks." He doesn't go that route. And if he did, do you think that probably would have started the church in Athens? I'm going to go with no. Okay? So the approach that we take, just the very way in which we go at sharing Jesus, is determined by the person that I am around. And sometimes it is, you know, you put on kid gloves, we sometimes say, you know, those small, if you're going to pretend to box. Surprised we even have those today. But anyway, put on these kid gloves. My point is, you do things in a very soft manner. You understand that where that person is at that moment in time, you know, someone who is grieving that says, "Why did God let my child die? Why did God let my mother die? Why did God let this happen?" Okay? To come in there and to say, "Well, you know, if you really had faith in Jesus Christ, you wouldn't be asking that as a question. It shows that your faith is really quite weak. You need to go back and read your Bible a little bit more and come to an understanding of who God is and the sovereignty of God, and you shouldn't be asking those questions." Is that going to be the right approach? No. We understand that. So when we come to the text that we are actually going to read now, and let's go to Mark chapter 1. You know, I can have all the right fishing equipment, and I'm not saying I do have all the right fishing equipment, but I could have all the right fishing equipment, and if you know me, and if you've been in my house for like a weekend, you would see me watching fishing videos on learning how to, different techniques of how to use different lures and that type of thing. And I will spend hours and hours doing that. So I can learn how to drop shot, and I can learn how to Texas rig and Carolina rig, and I can do all of these different type of retrieves. If I own the equipment and I watch the video and I read the books and I never go to the lake, am I a fisherman? No. I'm not. But yet I've got all the right equipment. I've watched all the right videos. I've read all the books. When it comes to being a fisher of men, there comes a point in time when we have to go fishing for people and get beyond the discussion and get into the reality. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell us the same basic story of Jesus calling Andrew and Peter and then James and John, these four fishermen. I'm going to come at it from Mark's account. Passing along the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going along a little farther, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat, mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. Jesus calls these physical fishermen to become fishers of men, of people. They've already had an interaction with Jesus down in Judea with John the Baptist, and had even met him down there. But they went back home. They went back to life. They went back to doing their thing. They had the spiritual revival, but then life had to go on. So they went back. Jesus is now up in Galilee, and he's walking along the seashore. He sees the very men that he had seen down in Judea, and he tells them, "Follow me." It's an invitation to change life. It's an invitation to live differently. It's an invitation to say, you have now an opportunity. You now have to make a choice. Do you stay where you are, or do you start walking where I walk, doing what I do, listening to what I teach, and then doing what I teach, following my command? That's what's going on. It's a pretty bold statement to say, follow me. Follow me is saying, I am the teacher, you are going to be the student. You need to understand that as a relationship, because I am going to then teach you. And they immediately leave everything and follow him. Part of my problem as a fisher of men, a fisher of people, is that I see them as just that, people. My children and their spouses, my grandchildren. I see people that I am acquaintances with in different places because of social different things that I am involved in. I have relatives, I have friends, you may have co-workers. And I see them as just that. I see them as that relationship. That is my daughter-in-law. That is my son-in-law. That is my son. That is my daughter. That is my grandchild. That is my friend. That is a co-worker. I tell you what I don't always see. I don't see their soul. I see the person. I don't necessarily see the soul. And that's the difference for me. That is the absolute difference for me. Because as a person, I've got all of this relationship that I want to maintain. And I do. I absolutely want to maintain it. When I see a soul, I see something even bigger than the relationship. Not that I want to destroy the relationship. I'm not trying to say that. But if I see a soul, then now I have to determine, one, my soul, and two, the soul of the other, are we right with God? Jesus taught people on a mountainside. We call it the Sermon on the Mount, hence a mountainside. And Matthew records for us the longer version in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. In Matthew 7, Jesus would say to that group of people, beginning in verse 13, actually, it's not. I don't know why I have that there. It's not the verse I want to go with. Oh, it is. I was in Matthew 5. I'm sorry. My Bible, my problem. Matthew 7, verse 13. Just look at the screen. It's much easier. Enter by the narrow gate, Jesus says to this group of people. For the gate is wide, the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow, and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few. Put yourself, for just a moment, put yourself on that hillside, listening to this itinerant rabbi teach. One that you have seen perform miracles. One that you know, or at least believe, is from God. And one that seems to love the unlovable, touch the untouchable, care for those nobody else cared about. And I want you to hear him say these words as you are listening. Enter by the narrow gate. That's the command. And then he tells you about two different ways. One is very wide, that he calls the easy way. One is very narrow. He calls it the hard way. The easy way has just that. Lots and lots of people take the easy road. I get that. In life, most people take the easy road. But Jesus says, spiritually speaking, the easy road leads to destruction. The narrow path, the narrow gate, the narrow way, he said, frankly speaking, there's few that even go down that road. But that's the road that leads to life. But few find it. Now you're sitting there. You've got an option. Am I one of the many? Or am I one of the few? Jesus didn't give you a third option. He only gave you two. Okay? Am I on a road that leads to destruction spiritually? Or am I on a road that leads to life? And Jesus is literally fishing for people. Throughout the course of this month, we're going to just take a look at different things, different techniques, different examples of this being a fisherman. Paul deeply, deeply loved the fellow Jews. He loved his kinsmen so much. When he writes the book of Romans, he has this outpouring of devotion of what he wants to see for them. But when we come to what we would say is chapter 10, Paul begins by saying, brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them, that's the Jewish people, is that they may be saved. He says, that's my prayer. That's my heart's desire. My desire and my prayer life is that my people would be saved. It is no different than saying my desire, my prayer is for the people of the United States of America to come to Jesus Christ, to give their lives to Jesus Christ. He says, that's my prayer. That's my people. He continues on. For I bear them witness, that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God, and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. As Paul writes this letter, he says, I love my people, and my prayer, my constant prayer, and Paul's constant beginning of fishing in any place he goes is to the Jewish people. He says, I pray for them. I pray for my people. I pray for my country, my countrymen. But I'll also bear witness. They say they know God, but they have no relationship with God. They have a zeal for God, but they have not understood the righteousness of God. Because the righteousness of God, especially just even if you took a look at verse 4 in your own Bible, is that it comes through Jesus Christ. And they weren't really to come to Jesus Christ. I've got a zeal for my religion. I've got a zeal for my belief system. I've got a zeal for the way I was brought up and raised, and my family was raised, and they were raised, and they were raised, and I can go back generation from generation. That's my zeal. And Paul says, the problem is, zealous doesn't equal saved. It doesn't. So you've got this passion for your past, your belief system, but if your belief system doesn't align to Jesus Christ, then as much as you love God, it's a false belief system. Okay, that I hate to make it that blunt, but there's where you are. Okay, if my belief system doesn't align to what Jesus teaches, my zeal makes no difference. Sitting in a hen house doesn't make you a hen. Sitting in a church building doesn't make you a Christian. You've heard all the platitudes. When Jesus called Peter, Andrew, James, and John, they were not fishers of people, souls. They were fishermen. That was their job. He said, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. It's not where they were at that moment in time. The first thing they had to do was follow. The first thing they had to do was decide, do I follow Jesus? Because if I do, which they did, and over those next couple of years, Jesus taught them how to become fishers of men. Now, I will tell you, my opinion, they were pretty slow learners. Okay? 3 years go by, and they're still having some of the same arguments and the same questions. They didn't get it. Growth takes some time. And it might with you too, okay? The resurrected Jesus comes back a week after his resurrection and meets his disciples in a locked upper room. Because in week one, the day of the resurrection, there was a person named Thomas, one of the 12, who was not there. And Thomas's statement to his fellow disciples of Jesus Christ was, unless I see the nail prints in his hands and in his feet and put my hand into his side, I will never believe. 3 years he had been with Jesus. And Jesus had talked about the suffering Savior. Jesus had talked about 3 days I'd have to be in the earth. Jesus had given them the sign of Jonah. He had taught them all of these things. Thomas says, if I don't see it, I don't believe. Jesus shows up that week later. Thomas is in that room. And he calls Thomas out. He says, take a look at my hands. Put your hand in my side. Stop disbelieving. Believe. Thomas's response was not, okay, let me do that. Wasn't his response. His response was, my Lord and my God. I'm all in. And it took him that long to get there. I'm telling you, when we go fishing for people, if you're expecting everybody to kind of jump in the baptistry next week, I hope it happens. But if it doesn't, sometimes you have to understand it takes a process and it takes time. But unless we're actually fishing, then all we're doing is just kind of coming here and talking theology and no soul is getting saved. So we come back. There is a broad, easy way, but that leads to destruction. There is a straight and narrow way that leads to life. Which one are you walking down? And that's a question you get to answer, even now, as we stand and as we sing.